Welcome to That Season Air podcast. I'm your host, Gina. Stick with me as I chat to season airs, expats and adventurers across the world, sharing their inspiring stories and interesting insights into living and working abroad. On today's show, I catch up with Somerset legend and author of Iberia by Bike, Jim Merrifield. In this episode, Jim runs us through his travel journey from his time winging windsurf instructing at Camp America to banana humping in Australia.
And we got to the bus station, we just got refused tickets, and then the police basically escorted us out. They said, in Latin American, you need to come with us. And we were like, okay. So that was a pretty scary moment.
Tune in as we find out how Jim got caught up in the corporate world and how his exit plan led him to a motorbike tour of Europe, inspiring the creation of his publishing company, A Merry Ride Round. As always, Jim shares his tips, tricks and travel hacks to help you on your next journey. And stick with us right to the end of the show as we hear Jim's experience of writing his first book while stuck in South America during the pandemic. If you enjoy the podcast and want to show your support for the show, you are now able to buy me a coffee via the link in the show notes. And without further ado, here's the show. Jim, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you very much, Gina. I'm very well, thank you. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. Ready for a chat this morning after having several problems with trying to get this recorded before. So thank you so much for being very patient in me with my kind of technical issues. But yeah, how are you doing? Where are you at the moment?
I'm currently in a small place called Colmorano in the La Marche region of Italy, so on the east coast. This morning I've been building steps outside.
Oh, really?
So we're sort of earning our keep, really. So we're doing a workaway currently. So I'm out here cycling through Europe, navigating the 90-day visa requirements. But we've decided to sort of slow down a little bit as we've been sort of, I'm just going to say rushing through, but cycling through, trying to get to Croatia. We're sort of taking a week in this. It's a beautiful area. We've got the Cibellini mountain range with snow caps on the top of the mountains, just over the hills. So yeah, thoroughly enjoying it.
So we met a few years ago now through our mutual friend, Nathan. The reason that I've got you on the show is because you also have a travel journey of your own. It's not season air orientated, but like, as you say, you are doing a workaway at the moment. And the interesting thing about that is you also started out down the corporate route and changed direction. And it's brought you to some very different places now. And that's why I've got you on the show, so that you can kind of give that information to our listeners and kind of spread the word about alternative routes through life. So we're going to go through your journey today. First things first, when you were at school, what did you want to do initially? Did you have any ideas of what your path might be at that point?
Truth be told, I wanted to play rugby for England. And then...
That's a great goal.
Yeah, so that was a pretty good
goal. Excuse the pun.
Yeah. But I realised that was, yeah, it was quite a short career. So then I was going to retire and own a pub called The Mighty Banana. That was my, right. That was my plan. But then sort of heading towards college and sixth form, I, you know, found other things in life to keep occupied, mainly partying and such like. So yeah, rugby was was very quickly not on the cards. I still play on an amateur level. But so I didn't really know after that point what I was going to do. The sort of the route through school was always, especially our school in Cheddar, and I think most likely others as well, was, you know, which university are you going, or which university are you going to after your gap year? And that never really appealed to me. I love the idea of uni. I would have loved to have gone, but I didn't see an option of what I wanted to study, really. I sort of did English and PE at college, and I did all right in the exams, but I wasn't prepared to pay $9,000 a year for doing it. So it was my age group where $9,000 was the first year for the first rise. So I decided to go traveling. I sort of spent sort of September through to December working on building sites, and then in a bar in the evening. So about three or four evenings a week, just sort of locally to save as much money as possible to head out. I went out to Thailand then in the new year, the sort of the Southeast Asia trip. So I went out as a fresh 18-year-old, naive and thirsty. Was the sort of was probably the label I would have given to the first bit of traveling. My parents had traveled quite a number of places sort of before my brothers and I were born. So we had all these like fantastic paintings and statues and things from like all over Indonesia and Africa scattered around the house, which I was a bit surprised. I thought either they had a massive suitcase that they came home with, like full of all these trinkets and such like, or they just went to Cheddar Car Boot and filled up and pretended that they were from all around the world. So I sort of always had the support from my parents to say, you know, you just do what you want to do. And if you want to go traveling, then crack on. And my brother went at 18 as well. So it was the classic sort of younger brother syndrome, you know, if he can do it, then so can I. So I think that sort of like stemmed an idea that I was able to go. I'm not quite sure why I chose Thailand. It was quite a well-trodden path. You see it everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great. So I spent 3 months sort of in Southeast Asia. So did the sort of the classic full moon party and then up to Pai in the north for hiking and all sorts. And then went to Cambodia, which I definitely preferred more than Thailand. There was a little island just off Cambodia that I sort of fell in love with called Koh Rong. And I spent a couple of weeks there. And then I sort of realized that actually I needed to be in Kuala Lumpur to fly to Australia in a couple of days. I thought, well, there's no way I'm going to get over land. I ended up flying from Phnom Penh to Kuala Lumpur. I spent 24 hours in Kuala Lumpur airport, very much on a budget in this case. So, you know, there was no accommodation, or I was just sort of slept on the floor in the corner. Got to Australia, and then so I spent 3 months in Australia, which again, I sort of ran out of money a little bit in Melbourne. So I've got family in Perth. So I stayed with them for a week, borrowed their transport, did a nice little tour of the West Coast. That was superb. Flew to Adelaide, went and visited a friend there for a week. And again, sort of had a tour guide to go around. And then I was sort of on my own again then with very little funds. So I started hitchhiking.
Okay.
So I hitchhiked to Melbourne. I then quite literally spent all of my money in an Irish bar, which I stayed for a few days. And there was a nice lad there who gave me his skateboard as he was flying home. So I thought, great, I've got a mode of transport now. So I bought a tent that with the sort of the last of the money I had, just a sort of a cheap one. And I found on Gumtree, people were driving to Mount Kosciuszko. So they've got the ski range there. This was sort of more in the summer, so more mountain bikers. And then I just went from there. So I would skateboard down hills and then hitch a lift up hills, and then made my way up to Canberra and Sydney, and spent 2 months doing that, basically. I got picked up by sort of all manner of people, really. There was like a family picked me up, and I stayed with them for a week or so, and ended up laying some dry stone paving outside the front of the house. They paid me in cash. It was like, great, right? You know, I can afford you know, a beer, or, you know, actually a decent meal that's not tuna and crackers. And then similarly, I did some carpet cleaning with a bloke. I did a day's work in exchange for staying at his house in Wollongong. And then I came home. So I was back in about 5 months. That was my first experience of traveling. It was good. I thoroughly enjoyed being on my own and having to make those decisions as an 18, just turned 19 at that point. So I was back home in May, June for a week. And then I flew out to Camp America for 3 months. So in that same year.
Oh, wicked. Did you do that through Camp America itself, or did you take one of the kind of alternatives?
So I went through Camp America itself.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to a chap, I can't remember his name.
John Marion,
yeah. Who was talking about it. And it's sort of similar scenario. I went straight through Camp America, and I just did all of the applications and the contacting. I didn't actually contact any camps, but I just sort of put my application out there. And I only got contacted by one camp. So I was like, well, I'm going to take this one, obviously.
Yeah.
If I want to do it, then yeah, it's just sort of my only choice. So that was going the direct with Camp America route. So I probably could have done more searching. If you are going to do it, then yeah, either be prepared to spend loads of time doing it, which I didn't have the option to do, sleeping in a tent in Australia without a smartphone. So that was not possible. But the camp was great. So I was up the camp was all right. It was up in, the experience was great. I definitely recommend doing it. It just depends if the camp is sort of suits your sort of needs and activities, really. So it was up in Maine, so on the northeast side with all the lakes.
And how was that experience?
It was interesting. So I've always done like football and rugby and athletics. And so I thought, you know, I'm going to be teaching things like that to kids. When I was 15, I did a year's windsurfing, sort of just at like Cheddar Reservoir. Again, my brother did it. So I was like, oh, I want to do it. And I wrote that on my application, and this camp phoned up and said, yeah, we'd like you to teach windsurfing. I thought, fucking hell. I've got no idea. Like, it's been so long since I'd done it. So I rang up a mate and I said, look, can you teach me how to windsurf again and sort of do all the tying of the booms and everything?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I rocked up at this camp, and you have all, like, a few weeks, like, initial training and for the counsellors where there's no kids involved. And I just remember, like, taking the windsurf out and just bailing, like, a lot. And then just a row of counsellors, like, stood on the lakeside going, you know, who is this guy? How is he teaching windsurfing? He can't do it. I think the previous year they'd had, like, a world champion from Hungary.
Oh, right.
Who was just, like, going out and, like, doing flips on the lake and it was just incredible. So these guys told me this, and I'm thinking, oh, my days. Like,
it's a lot to live up to.
Yeah, exactly. So I basically thought, right, I've got to come at this from a different angle, and I'm not going to be able to teach them by demonstrating. I mean, fortunately, you know, they're 8 to 15-year-olds, so the chances are that they're going to be better than me were slim, although there was a couple, which was, yeah, not great. But so I've got to come at a different angle. So you formulate all these lesson plans, and that part was really enjoyable, and thought, right, I've just got to be able to talk a good game. What I have on the last guy from Hungary is he didn't speak very good English, so apparently he would just shout, push and pull was the main things that he could teach. I thought, right, okay, I've got that edge. So I started out first lesson, and then there was a kid that I thought could windsurf. So I chucked him out on the lake, and it was quite strong, and it was boom, downwind, as far as you can. The lake we shared with other camps, so he was well out of our territory. I'm thinking, you know, I've only got an hour with this lad, and then I've, you know, got to bring him back in. I've got another lesson. So this was first lesson, and then so this camp was like the third most expensive camp in America, but the equipment was dreadful. So I had, like,
oh, no.
I mean, you windsurf, you've done
no.
someone was talking. Ah, no, someone was talking about kite surfing. But basically, you know,
Teresa Cullen,
that was it. Yeah. So you need grip on your windsurf boards as a bare minimum, and these windsurfing boards were absolutely ancient, along with every other equipment that they had. Mm-hmm. So they were making an absolute mint, charging through the nose for camps, and just having this bare basic equipment. So this kid shot off down the lake, and they had this old, like, 10 horsepower motorboat, which I wasn't allowed to use. So I had to take out a rowing boat, go and pick him up. And I was about half an hour late for the next lesson. So I thought, well this isn't going to work. Like, I can't windsurf. The kids can't windsurf. So I started just by doing everything on land, and then tied, like, three lengths of rope together on the pontoon, and then tied it to the front of their board, and then sent them out. So that they'd basically just had a long piece of rope. I could stand on the pontoon, you know, not make a fool of myself, and just shout directions at them. And that works really well in the end. I also found a paddle board works quite well. So I could use the stick to tell them about hand position. So that was good. And then halfway through, we had the open day, like, parents come and visit.
Yeah.
So I think, oh, okay, you know, how am I going to pretend that, that I know what I'm talking about? And then I had this one lad called Theo, and his parents were, like, literally stood right there, and I'm chatting away, and I actually had quite a good lesson. He was sort of seven lessons in at that point, and he was starting to learn how to windsurf. So I got that day out of the way, and then at the end of the camp, the main director bloke read out a letter from Theo's parents, and in it said, Jim, the windsurfing instructor, was world class. And I almost, like, fell off my chair. All the other counselors looked around and go, what on earth? Like, how have you managed that? I got a standing ovation. So that was a really nice end to that.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you didn't need any qualifications for that? You just turned up and they were like, you can do this now.
Yeah, yes, exactly. So, well, I mean, we had a video call, and they said, you know, are you confident in teaching windsurfing? I know you've not done loads of it. And it's that classic, like, you know, I want to go and do this, so yes, I will make it happen sort of moment, you know, saying yes and then figure out how to do it later, which I've, doing that at 19, I've sort of taken that through everywhere that I've said, look, I was a windsurf instructor. I didn't even know how to windsurf. So I've used that as quite a few examples in job interviews. Yeah.
So how long were you in Maine for?
So I did, that was about 2 months, I think, is the total count, 2.5 months. And then you have usually have a few weeks to travel or, you know, do whatever you like or fly home. So I still didn't have very much money. I got paid for it. So I went down to Boston, me being unorganized, didn't book anywhere. And everyone else that had done Camp America had booked everywhere. So Boston was completely rammed with no accommodation that I could afford. So I jumped on a bus to New York. I thought there's bound to be a hostel in the center of Manhattan. Turns out there's not. So I walked around for a long time in Manhattan, basically, till it got to about 1 o'clock in the morning. I thought, right, I'm either just like sleeping on a park bench in Central Park, or I try and get into a bar at 19. And I borrowed an expired driving license from one of the counselors. So I don't know, should I say the name on here? Oh, he's not going to listen to it. So yeah, my name is Gabriel P. Wallace from Boston. So I got into, again, an Irish bar. They seem to just suck all of my money, these places. And I started chatting to a wedding party and I said, look, you know, do you know of any hostels? You know, completely with the intention to like stay at one of their houses. And yeah, this bloke said, right, you can come and crash on my couch. You know, if you just buy me a hot dog and, you know, and if you're all right, if you're a normal bloke, then that'd be all right. I said, fantastic.
I do.
So the first experience in New York was sitting on a rooftop in Brooklyn watching the sun come up, basically, sort of over Manhattan. So that was pretty special.
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Going back to leaving camp, everyone that's kind of come on and said they worked at camp, you don't earn a lot of money doing that. Is that what the problem was, that you didn't have a lot of money after leaving there, or was it quite well paid? What was your experience of that?
It wasn't that well paid. I thought, you know, this camp had loads of money. I thought, oh, yeah, I'm going to be in it. But they the first year that you do, because Camp America sort a lot of everything out for you, and your sort of contract goes through Camp America, you get significantly less.
Right.
You get paid a lot more, and you can negotiate more for subsequent years.
Right.
So okay. you deal then directly with the camp. Because I said, they asked me back. I don't know why, but they asked me back. And I said, look, I'm really sorry. I want to go to Glastonbury Festival and I've got, you know, other things on. And they said, well, what is it about the money? I said, no, you know, it's not about the money in this case. But that opened up the thought. I said, well, look, I could negotiate here and have that option. So, yeah, the first year is not particularly well paid. But I also didn't go out with very much money because I'd spent it all in Australia. So I was digging into savings at this point.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was sort of a bit of both, really. If you're prepared for it and you go out and you have a little bit of money in your pocket, you can obviously make the subsequent travel significantly better because you have, it might be even be a month or something afterwards, or at least like 3 weeks. And I knew guys that were like flying to LA and like exploring California, and you know, I could only afford to jump on a bus and, you know, head down to New York. And then went down to this like tiny little festival in Pennsylvania, with like a plastic sheet as a tent. Because, well, Glastonbury was on and I'd missed it and I was a bit gutted.
Oh, no. So
I found these local people from Pennsylvania, and as soon as they found out I was English, that was it. I was just talking for the entire festival. But I got loads of free beer and all sorts. So, yeah, that was great.
So that's where you went after New York, was it?
So yeah, after New York, I stayed with a friend of mine. India was out doing a different camp, and her friend Molly lived in New York. So she sorted me out. Shout out to Molly. She sorted me out for a few days and I stayed there, and I came back and stayed there again. So yeah, then I jumped on a bus to Philadelphia with the sole intention of going to this little festival. I think it was called Stir Fry Music Festival. It was one of those ones, it was in like the woods. They have two stages. So you go from one stage, listen to a band, and then everyone goes to the next stage and listens to the next band.
Cool.
So I managed to get a bus to the town nearby, Pennsylvania. Each state has completely different laws. So you could buy beer in a supermarket in New York, but you couldn't buy beer in a supermarket in Pennsylvania. So they have these own breweries that close early. So it got to like, it was about 9, 10 o'clock, and I was like, well, I could do with having a beer and getting off to bed. And so I found a hotel and they wanted to charge me $40 for a night, which now I'm thinking, you know, that's not too bad. But at the time, I was like, I haven't got $40. Like, I'm going to be up at like 4:30 in the morning to go to this festival, because it was a, you know, it was a good hike away. So I decided I slept behind the back of the brewery. I had all like the sleeping bag and everything. So I slept there, waited for that to open, and then flashed my ID. So can I have a case of beer, please? And then, yeah, trundled that over to the festival and made some really good friends who I'm in contact with now. And so then I then stayed with friends in Allentown. Shout out to Allentown, Pennsylvania. Basically, I just got introduced to all of the neighbours and never met an English person before. Most people didn't believe that I was English.
Oh, really?
I was like, well, I'm not quite sure. You know, fair enough. just because they'd never met one, so they just thought I was an American guy pretending to be English to try and hook up with girls or something.
That's so random.
Yeah. So then that was about the end of that. I then managed to get back to New York. And then, yeah, came home. So right. Skint at this point.
So you went home, and where did you go from there? What was the plans once you got home?
I just absolutely loved traveling. And I was like, I've just had the absolute best time. I'm still not sure if I want to go to university. I've not had any time to look at it. Mm-hmm. So I thought, I'm just going to get a job and then go from there. So I started painting and decorating with a couple of local people. So it was quite a sort of high-end residential stuff. And then also worked for a mobile bar company. So you go down to like weddings and set up in a marquee, and you spend the whole day with the guests, and then you pack up and go away. So we did that all over the Southwest. That was a really good job, actually. There was two of us, and we'd take it in turns each weekend. You know, one would drink with the guests and the other one would drive. So so that was really good. She's trying to like spur people to come to the bar and, you know, offering the occasional free shots and going from there. So that was a mix of the two jobs, and that was basically solely to earn money to go back out traveling. Now, I chose Australia again. I thought I'd had a good time at home, so it wasn't like solely saving, but mm-hmm. So I wanted the opportunity to work and earn money again. And Australia for me seemed, I'd enjoyed it the last time, that seemed for me that the best option to earn some money and then carry on traveling. I wanted to do like the Pacific Isles and go out there. I didn't get around to it in the end. So mm-hmm. I lined up a job in Western Australia. Said I've got family out in Perth. So they helped. So I was putting up fence lines in the outback for cattle stations and mine sites. That's probably the most well paid I've ever been.
Really?
Yeah. So the Australian visa was pretty easy to get as a Brit. And then I think it's changed now, but to get a second year visa, you mm-hmm. have to do those 3 months sort of work in a rural job. So
right.
Like picking fruit or something is typically what people do. But so I had a contact, so I managed to get this fencing gig. So yeah, it was out in the outback, and so barbed wire fences. There was one, I remember, it was this cattle station the size of Kent, the county.
Wow.
And three people lived on it. So in the morning, I know it was bonkers, just like this, the absolute scale, it's like blew yeah. my mind. So we used to drive out to the boundary, and we did one fence that was 24 kilometres in a straight line.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, of fence lines. So yeah, so that, I mean, that was really long days, and I think I probably earned about $21,000 Australian dollars in 3 months.
Oh wow.
Which I think at the time was about 11 grand.
Ah, okay.
British pounds, 12 grand. So great. I'm like, this is great. I couldn't do any more work. It was quite wasn't very good for the brain. Basically, okay. You're sort of like tying fences together. And
did you actually get to see a lot of Australia in that time? Because you must have been working all the time.
Yeah, so we would do like 2 weeks on and then get a few days off.
Right, okay.
To explore the area. So for those 3 months, I saw a lot of the Australian outback and some of the and the towns, these little towns like dotted around.
Yeah.
Which was interesting, but again, it wasn't really, it's not what you go traveling for. It's not like any particular big sites. I think the one landmark was like the world's largest or Australia's largest gold mine. So that was the peak of the excitement, really. if you're into that sort of thing. So, but that was just like, right, I'm going to do 3 months. I'm going to earn my second year visa, and then I'm going to buy a van and I'm going to travel around Australia.
Right.
Just keen for the open road. Australia's got a lot of them. So I was like, oh, brilliant. You know, that's what I'll do. So I bought a van, it's like an old beat up Ford Econ van. And my older brother actually came out for a wedding. It was his friend George. So I managed to blag an invite to that.
Okay, nice.
So I was with my brother, and I said about like, I could only do 3 months of this work because I came out of it and I couldn't hold a conversation with a normal person. So like it was really quite strange.
Because the work had sort of taken a toll mentally on you? Or?
I think I'd literally been talking, it had taken quite a toll mentally. We're literally talking about barbed wire fences from, you know, waking up in the morning to go to bed to that extent. So in a group of people that I knew, you know, that are like family friends that I should have been very comfortable speaking with, mm-hmm. I was quite anxious and I had to do a lot of like brain work to try and come out of that. My brother was like, yeah, you're in a weird place. So
yeah.
Money was great. You know, hours, I did enjoy the work, but so I did struggle mentally after it, sort of coming out of it. So mm-hmm. I think the heat of the desert as well did some weird things to me, I think, because it was like 40 plus degree heat for a while. So that was a strange experience. Yeah. So I brought this van. That then got stolen.
What?
Yeah. So
how?
Well, I'd put it up for sale. So I bought this van and it wasn't quite what I wanted. So I put it up for sale. You know, I had all this money and, you know, it was burning a hole in my pocket. So, and I found a 1984 Toyota Land Cruiser that I fell in love with.
Nice.
Like driving past, and I was like, oh my gosh, like I want that. So I was looking at buying this. So I was selling the van. Loads of people came around to look at it. I don't know, because this van was advertised, this is where it is.
Yeah.
We woke up in the morning, I was taking my brother to the airport, he was flying home, and the van was gone. And it was like that moment. Did you park the van somewhere else? I'm pretty sure the van was parked there. So I had to get my brother to the airport. We then found the van at the bottom of the hill. So they'd obviously tried to jump start it, but failed. So they'd gone at it with a chisel. They'd stolen all of the mattress out the back, and sort of all the doors were sort of like caved in. I mean, the mattress had a spring coming out of it. I wasn't particularly worried. The joke's on them, really. So I took my brother to the airport, came back, phoned the police, and I was like, right, okay. So I ended up sold the van for a lot less than I bought it for.
Mm-hmm.
So I lost quite a lot of money on that, but I had this beautiful Toyota Land Cruiser now. So this, I was like, right, great. You know, whatever happens, that's fine. So I picked up a couple of people. I wrote an advert on Gumtree mm-hmm. in Australia. Gumtree is a bit different than like in the UK and possibly anywhere else. You'd like, because Australia is so big, there's lots of lift shares. So I was driving from here to Adelaide. So I took a couple of people, just like wild camping, and then drove to Melbourne. So I picked up a couple of friends that were also out traveling. So I was out on my own, but actually a lot of the time I was with people that I knew and we'd had a good time. So I ended up going all the way up to Brisbane. And it was at that point I'd sort of run out of money, or I knew I needed to carry on working. You know, I'd won a year working visa. I can't just be on a bit of a jolly the whole time. Yeah. So I did door-to-door sales.
Oh, right.
For a company called Aussie Farmers.
Okay.
Which was great. I could get behind that. You know, I'm a big advocate of, you know, shopping within the country that you live and supporting local farmers. And so it was door-to-door sales and, you know, milk delivery, fresh fruit and veg delivery. But then that moved, the team closed down for something and the team moved over to Melbourne or something. So I then started doing solar panels, which again, you know, I can see why you would get solar panels in Australia. It's pretty sunny. So I was quite passionate about that. I think I really struggled selling something that I didn't believe in.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was about 2 months total. No, 3 months total in Brisbane. And then, so I would like use the showers from the swimming pool. And then one morning, basically, it was like a paradise swimming pool. So like mm-hmm. lovely, like sandy beaches and palm trees. And they had this pebble dash drains underneath the pool, and I basically dived in head first and I managed to smash my nose. You might be able to see it. I'll get a bit closer. And I think it was Tom West I was listening to, and that sparked the sort of the memory about having loads of doctors in the room, you know, like assessing where you're at. And basically this is split like a little starfish.
Oh no.
So each doctor was like, oh, I'm not sure how we're going to stitch that up, you know, so we'll get the next one and the next one and the next one. And there's three of them like looking into your eyes. Like the death stare. So I had this bandage on, it was like a T, and I had work the next day, and I actually got quite a lot of sales the next day selling
sympathy sales.
I think it was a big T for twat on my head. But I got quite a few sales in that. And then another friend came out, he'd been playing cricket over there. I'd earned a bit more money. Brisbane's brilliant. It was probably one of my favorite cities out of Australia. And then we drove up to Cairns, just sort of like finding remote spots to sleep in and going from there. I dropped him off, and at that point I was really skint. So I had this truck, it was worth, you know, a few grand, but I didn't have any money. I had half a tank of fuel and a plastic bag full of food. That was probably one of the most challenging moments in terms of, right, I need a job and I need to get paid fast. So I found a free campsite, like no services really, and then would start like calling farms. And the only one that I could find that was like available for work was this banana farm. And okay. I rang him up. I said, "Hi, you know, my name's Jim. Like, really excited. You know, I'm here for about a month and a half. You know, looking for a job. Have you got any work?" I said, "Oh, sorry, but, you know, we only employ people for a minimum of 3 months." I'm thinking, oh, shit.
Oh, no.
I've just put my foot in it, trying to process all of this. Rang other farms. There's literally nothing available. So I know this farm is hiring. Yeah. How can I now get a job there? So I drove to the farm and I said, "Hi, my name's James, which is my real name. You know, I'm here for a minimum of 3 months." Unfortunately, you know, I wasn't. "You know, have you got any jobs?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, you know, we've got loads." I'm thinking, great. That's the beauty of having two names. But just everyone called me James from then on in. So there's a lot of times people would say James and I wouldn't react. I'd be like, "Oh, shit, yeah, all right." So I got a job there and I was a banana humper.
All right.
Yeah. So I'm very proud to have banana humping on my CV. Essentially, bananas grow in bunches, don't they? So you chop down the tree and then you grab them and you take it with your shoulder and then you carry it to a trailer, banana humping.
Right, okay.
That was a great job. I say I had no money. There was a campsite where the other workers were working and there was a free bus that would take you in.
Yeah.
They gave me like 3 weeks of free stay until I got paid. And there was an Aussie bloke that was working at the banana farm, and he rocked up one day with like $100 in cash to give to me to tie me over to payday. And I was like, "Man, I've just met you. How do you know I'm not just going to scarp?" And he goes, "Well, I don't really." But
oh, that's so,
so that
nice.
That was awesome. I think you get those type of challenges back home, or, you know, looking for work, where you have to think outside of the box, but you don't get that kind of generosity when you're in your own country. And I think when you're out on the last legs, people start to see the desperation and they react to it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I worked there for a couple of months, sold the truck, and then it was about time for Glastonbury Festival. So I came home. So, yeah.
Awesome. So you went home to go and work at Glastonbury.
Yeah.
What was kind of the plan after that? You've obviously used your visa.
Yeah. So I actually still have my second year visa. So I went home basically for Glastonbury. I do 3 weeks at Glastonbury building bars. It's a gig my brother got me. So it was 3 weeks at Glastonbury. I thought, right, okay, I'm going to get paid for this. And then I will do my second year visa. Wanted to go to New Zealand. Didn't manage to get there whilst I was there. So I was going to carry on this role. And so I did a few weeks painting and decorating after Glastonbury. And I've moved in with my mum at this point. And was struggling a bit, to be honest. Love my mum. Big shout out to mum. But, you know, for anyone that's moved away and then moves back, knows exactly what you're talking about. So I thought, right, okay, I need more money. I'm going to go to Bristol, try and find a job. So applied everywhere, really. Like, I thought, I'm just going to do a year, save enough money, and then leave. And that was when, basically, I sort of got sucked into this recruitment gig, where I spent the next 4 years. So what was meant to be a year to save money, and thought, right, okay, I'm just going to go in. I'm just going to, you know, milk them for everything that they've got in a year, and I'm going to leave, you know, and go from there, really.
Tell us about that job. How did you end up staying there for 4 years?
Yeah. So, I mean, this quite easily could have happened to me at sort of 18 and for like people leaving college. So I'd heard of recruitment sort of, and they're always advertising for recruitment consultants. It's a pretty busy, like, saturated market. There's loads of agencies claiming to be the best. For a friend that I was painting and decorating with, his friend worked for this like high-end FTSE listed recruitment company. So I rocked up and went to the interview, and I was in like Asda Price shoes and like charity shop trousers, and rocked up to this interview and managed to get it basically from, it's like talking about experiences that I'd had when I was traveling and like working hard abroad, which is why I'm such a big advocate of it. I didn't have a university degree. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any specific qualifications in that such, but I always had an example of something that I'd done when sort of living and working abroad.
Yeah.
I thought, all right, I'll do a year. That'd be great. And then I started getting promoted quite quickly. I was quite good at it. What came with the promotions was significant pay rises. And I thought, you know, I had more money than I could ever like imagine getting paid for a job, let alone at like 23.
Yeah.
So I was like, right, okay, this is pretty good. I'm just going to stick it out for a bit longer. And there were parts of it that I enjoyed. It was it wasn't a boring office job. The actual work was pretty monotonous. But what they do is they band that in with, you know, if you work hard, we'll take you out drinking and we'll, you know, we'll take you on holidays. And, you know, we do all these fun things at Christmas and office nights out and all this, all these rewards that actually it was just, you know, sort of bribing you to work as hard as, you know, to work as hard as you can.
Yeah.
So I was doing like a lot of work, long days. And I sort of started thinking, oh, maybe I could just build my way up this ladder and I'll be on X amount in the next couple of years. And I sort of got there and I actually, it was just, it was more stressful than it was worth. Started having conversations about, you know, like buying a car and buying a house, like buying a new car. And people were like, oh, Jim, you know, you're a manager now. Surely you're going to be buying a car soon. And I was like, well, no, that like, I've never wanted a new car. I was quite happy with my beat up old Volkswagen Golf.
Yeah.
But then I started thinking about all of these things and I was buying, you know, work shirts. I had like a dozen work shirts. Who needs a dozen work shirts? There's only 5 days in the week and one of them, you know, is mufti. So it was like, I just started like buying all this stuff that I didn't need and I didn't really want and actually struggling a little bit. So I found it. I didn't really know what it was, but I got the job. I just became wrapped up in the life of a suit. There's money everywhere. You know, everyone has a laugh. We go out for beers, you know, in the middle of the week. I'd always felt I was, you know, pretty aware of my values and sort of right and wrong. And I think there and throughout the course of like the 4 years, I think I just was pretending to stick to my values. But actually, you know, a lot of the work, I was placing engineers in like coal companies and for oil and gas companies because there was so much pressure on getting this deal done and making all of this money, not really giving, you know, two hoots about environment degradation or actually giving it, you know, caring about anyone else in the office or the work that they do because of this aspect. It's like, well, if you do this deal, then you can get this. And I'm like, oh, I want this.
Yeah, yeah. And it must become quite a competitive atmosphere as well.
It's a huge competition. Yeah, huge competition. So I felt like I could see other people wrapped up in it as well, where it actually had really good, I met some lovely people there that, that really had the right, like selfless values at heart, but you get wrapped up in this competition. I need to do this. These are my targets. If I don't hit those targets, I'm going to go on performance management, which I don't want to be on performance management. So I'm going to do everything that I can to get that deal over the line in any way, basically. So,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, the competition is great. Like, I play rugby. I love competition. That's great. But in the work environment, when you're talking about your own lifestyle, that had quite a bad mental impact on myself just because I didn't stay true to my values, really.
Yeah, it's got to take its toll.
Yeah,
I mean, there's healthy competition and then there's this sort of toxic competitiveness that you can get into, isn't there? So
yeah, that's it. So that
it's quite a far cry from banana humping in Australia.
Yeah, I think the backstory was sort of part of the reason why they. I don't know. No one else had come from sort of my sort of background, really. Mm-hmm. Like I was a painter, decorator, turned banana humper, turned fence erector, turned recruitment consultant. That I'd sort of broken all of these promotion records and was good at it. And they said, you know, you can come from anywhere and succeed in this company and climb the ladder and be happy at the next stage. And it was like, well, you know, I'm actually not that happy at the next stage. I learned a lot about business and about the way things operate and negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I did that door-to-door sales in Australia, so that helped me get this job as well.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
I don't know. It reached the point, about 2 years in, it was a case of I'm just going to work as hard as I can, earn as much money as possible. And then after about 3 years in, the job got a bit monotonous. I would start at 9, I would leave at 5, and I'd go home and I'd smoke tons of weed and just to try and like forget about the fact that I wasn't miserable or depressed, I don't think. I just wasn't happy with the type of work that I was doing.
Yeah,
I was living with some pretty close friends and I think they noticed a bit of a change in me as well. And then I started to notice it. And I thought, right, okay, you know, I don't want to be doing this forever. I never did want to do it forever, but it reached a point where it became too much. So I set in play like an exit plan. I thought, right, I'm going to... So at like the start of the year, so this is 2019 now. At the start of like January, I was like, right, okay, I'm just going to do 8 more months, just ticking it over. At the same time, I mean, I did manage to claw back some of the, the values that I thought I held true. Mm-hmm. So I used to run the corporate social responsibility program. We did lots of work with the homeless charities in Bristol, running interview workshops and things like that. And that part I really enjoyed. Like this massive company I was working for and all these resources. So I started throwing that around, which made me feel a little bit better about myself. Come June, I did 3 weeks at Glastonbury again and then left in August with a plan. Well, not really much of a plan then. So I didn't have a job to go into. The initial plan was to take some time off. The money was obviously very helpful in that sense that I'd earned from it. I didn't go down the route of buying new cars like everyone else seemed to do, or, you know, a house, etc. And that did fund, you know, the job did fund me to go out to Austria and see Nathan, and that's where I met yourself. And so the exit plan was just to take some time out. I picked up a motorbike license, so I passed that. I bought a big shiny motorbike. It was a Honda Shadow, sort of, if you picture like a Harley Davidson, so sort of like our hands up. I purchased that. And I thought, I'm just going to ride around Europe for a bit on my motorbike with my tent. I also took my puppet monkey with me. That's a whole another story.
So now we're getting on to the next chapter of your journey. And this chapter you've actually written a book about. So we'll get onto that and how that came about. But where were you heading on your bike?
Sure. Yeah. So sorry, I sort of touched on the plan I mean, that was it. It was just not to work very much, take some time out to sort of reevaluate what the next steps were. So I wasn't quite sure where I was heading. So this was at the end of September at this point. So I'd had, you know, a month off from work. It was my grandmother's 90th birthday. So I was absolutely, you know, definitely staying for that. Aww. She's a bit of a hero and definitely a role model. So end of September, got a ferry to Spain, to Bilbao. Mm-hmm. And then that was it, really. I was just going to, you know, ride around Europe until the weather got so bad that I didn't want to sleep in a tent anymore. Because you're sort of heading towards the end of the year. September, October is a fantastic time to be in Europe. You know, you've got all the autumnal colours are superb. It's not as busy. It's not as hot, but you've still got some great weather. So I actually crossed the Pyrenees and went, basically like drove to the Alps, or the base of the Alps, so Grenoble. And I met with a guy that I'd worked with, contracted with, who'd moved back to France, sort of, I suppose, sort of Brexit, really. So I stayed with them for a few days and then hit basically south coast of France, back across the Pyrenees, spent a few days in Barcelona, headed inland down to Granada, which is brilliant. Granada's probably out there with one of my favourite places, or favourite cities, at least. I picked up my girlfriend, Tash, for her week holiday. She disembarked in Malaga Airport in like motorbike jacket and like stuffed with socks and clothes and like a carry-on rucksack. I mean, you can only sort of imagine like the Bristol to Malaga flight each year and the clientele that are on there. She was very different. So then we've got some friends in Almeria that lived in Bristol. So we visited them. I dropped Tash back in Malaga and then sort of went all the way up the coast of Portugal. Hit Porto, crossed inland, and then quite high up. But that got pretty cold in the tent, actually. And then sort of over Lyon, over the mountains, hit some snow. And then back to Santander. So it was a bit of a loop, mostly following the coasts. And by the time it got to sort of like the 20th of November, I think, we'd had some pretty big storms. The tent was on its last legs. And I decided I'd book a ferry home. Then there wasn't a ferry. I rang them up and they said, oh, yeah, the ferry's having their version of the MOT, basically. So they only had one operating. I was like, that was really well put. So they only had one operating. So I had to wait another 2 weeks. It was the start of December or end of November. I came home. Mm-hmm. I thought, right, I'll camp on the coast. Essentially, the tent collapsed on me in the middle of the night.
Oh, no.
In a storm. So I spent a whole night. I was awake, basically, like re-pegging in and holding up the tent. No. So the tent, I mean, the tent I got from Glastonbury Festival. So there is a large bunch of people that leave their tents behind on the belief that, you know, they get recycled and sent to Calais. They definitely don't. So I picked up this like really nice Van Gogh tent. So I took that around with me. So it was a free tent. It, you know, it done well more than it's due. So yeah, it was definitely time to come home then. That was some pretty big challenges on that trip.
So you documented that whole trip in one way or another with your notebook?
Yeah. So I didn't go out on the trip with the intention, I'm going to document this and I'm going to write a book about it, which is why I've enjoyed the process so much, I think. I've always carried a notebook. My cousin bought me one for when I went out to Thailand, you know, the first trip. Mm-hmm. So I've always kept a daily journal or diary, I suppose, just of like things that I've done that day, things that I remember. I've since had quite a few bangs to the head, so there's a lot of stuff I don't remember.
Oh, no.
So having a notebook is very useful. And just lots of little things started happening to me. I was on my own. You know, I was still quite thirsty at that point. The French wine's brilliant. Spanish wine is also equally good. So, you know, I'd have, you know, a couple of glasses of wine in the evening and I'd sit down and I would write. And I started, you know, I'm quite enjoying this. I've got... Yeah. Quite a lot of good content. I think I had a conversation with my mum halfway through. And I was like, do you know what? I think I've got enough to write a book. So that was quite a nice realization. I have read other people's travel memoirs, so to speak. So I came back and I thought, I'm not working. I was partially looking for a job. So I'm going to start writing a book. And then, yeah, so it went from there, really. We also, Tasha and I had planned to go out to South America. We'd sold everything. We sold our car and we were going to do workaways. So we set up a workaway account and we were going to volunteer around South America. And I was just going to write in every spare moment, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, I did the travelogue on a motorbike. It's not about motorbikes. I wanted to be, you know, a big advocate. You don't have to like motorcycles to read it.
Yeah, let's talk a bit more about the book, though, because you kind of skimmed over your journey there. Didn't talk too much about your time in Europe. And I just want to go through some highlights of that. I've been reading the book. I've got a copy here.
Oh, hello. Yeah.
You've got lots of different stories, lots of different experiences in there. So what were a couple of memorable experiences or like your favorite places that you ended up going to? So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So it was about the journey. I was doing long days riding. So I'd do about anywhere between sort of 400 and 500 kilometers a day riding. It wasn't like I'm going to go and do all the tourist destinations and sort of have a look around and be a real tourist. You know, I'd not long passed my motorcycle license, so I was there to ride the bike. It does give you a lot of thinking time as well doing that. I mean, some of the highlights for me were a couple of little cities scattered around Le Puy and Valais in France was superb, just beautiful. They have an illumination light show on from like the whole of summer, which is just absolutely incredible. They sort of cast all these images on all the old buildings that they've got. The south of France wasn't really for me. It was very touristy, very expensive. I don't want to give away all the stories that I've got in the book, so I'm trying to navigate.
Yeah, not too many spoilers.
No, exactly.
But you've got to sell it.
So the book is called Iberia by Bike. A very quick history lesson. I don't know too much about it, but Iberia is the Iberian Peninsula, is the southwest peninsula of Europe. So Portugal, Spain, and you know the bottom bit of France. I'm from the southwest in the UK, so I quite liked that sort of tie-in with it. Essentially, it follows a little bit. I mean, you've read the prologue. It talks a little bit about the office and the job and how I was struggling with that, and then sort of moves into being a travel memoir. But I would just say sort of relatively descriptive in terms of the places that I've been to. I was thinking about, you know, if people wanted to go and do a similar journey, then it's got like roads on there and description of the roads and places and recommendations and how you find wild camps if you wanted to. Wild camping is technically illegal, but, you know, if you're doing it at that time of year, there's not so many people around or at least looking for you in the bushes. Mm-hmm. So it visits a number of little places in France and Spain and Portugal that you wouldn't necessarily find typing in holiday destinations in such and such. I give a breakdown of Barcelona and how it's best to access Barcelona from, you know, if you're traveling by bicycle or motorbike or van. So there's like free shuttles into Barcelona and how you can do that in the most cost-effective ways. I was very much a tourist in Barcelona, so but that's quite a we did this, you can do this, and there's various options, and this was my perspective on that time there. And then similarly for the south coast as well. So
from what I've read up to, I'm just about to start chapter 8, And from what I've gauged so far, you've got a lot of useful information in there, but also some like entertaining little stories and your experiences. Like in one of the earlier chapters, for example, you have one of your first encounters with someone who doesn't speak any English at all and totally don't know what this lady's trying to say to you and communicate and kind of show sort of your experience of those kind of things. So it's really good. It's entertaining, easy to read as well. Super easy to read, which is good for me because I'm not a big reader. So yeah, super easy to read. And
good. Yeah.
Really enjoying it at the minute.
I said my vocabulary is not that extensive. So yeah, it is very much, it is easy to read. There's no sort of mind boggling. I wrote it how I would want to read something of that. Yeah. Of that story, of that travel memoir. So
your Southwest does come through in it, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
Good. Yeah. There is no place quite like home. So yeah, I did try to sort of reference that sort of throughout. But I've seen some fantastic places, you know, around the world. But to come home to Cheddar Gorge is it's still pretty beautiful. So it's still home. So yeah, it's a bit of a running thing to compare everything that we see to Cheddar Gorge.
How does one go about doing that then? For anyone who's thinking, I've got a story to tell, how do you actually go about writing a book?
First things first is do it. Like speaking about myself in great detail is quite new for me. So I felt it easier to write things down and some of the experiences that I'd had and my thought process throughout that. There are two routes to market, basically. So, I mean, the official route or the old school route through the likes of Penguin or, you know, book publishers is you approach an agent or your publishers, give them a list or like the first three chapters of your book or your idea, and this is on paper, and really sell your story, and you get a book deal. So, you know, you get an advancement to write it, and then you get, you know, a small proportion of the royalties to do that. I decided against going that route because I had so much time on my hands, and I thought, you know, I want to make this my own. This could be, you know, I wanted to learn about every process of the publishing cycle, basically. So I've gone the self-published route, and they call it being an indie author or an independent author. So I've basically been in charge of everything from the people that design the book covers to the editing to the formatting inside, and I've been able to engage with independent contractors on that front rather than having, you know, getting a book deal, you know, writing all of my words down, these are my words, now make this into a book, and you don't really get any say in the rest of it if you get a book deal. So I wanted to do the whole thing myself. It was quite a bit of upfront capital to do that, but in return you get a bit more of the royalties per book sold after that. But then obviously you've got to do all of the marketing, so you've got making the book and then you've got to try and sell it. Yeah, it's an ongoing process, but it's been really enjoyable. I would recommend it to anyone to give it a go.
How did you figure out that process? You've never written a book before. Did you just kind of put it into Google?
Yes, essentially that was step one. Publish my book, and you get absolutely bombarded with companies saying, "We'll publish your book. We'll do all your marketing strategies. Just pay us, you know, a couple of grand, and we'll do everything for that." And I was like, "Well, this is just mind-boggling. So how do I navigate between that?" After I decided I was going the self-published route, there's loads of blogs and people that you sort of get the gist that they're there for you rather than just to make money. Yeah. And there is a lot of free advice. I found what's called the Alliance of Independent Authors. And they basically, for a small subscription fee, they give you, and it's about being an ethical author, basically. So, for example, not writing your own reviews and also as a very sort of basic thing, but being ethical throughout every step of the process, because there's so many of these companies that will publish your book for you and are absolutely having you on. Yeah. So don't just click on the first step on Google by any stretch. Yeah, I was obviously writing, but before I committed to anything, I spent hours of research. And I think I got that from doing office work, and in the recruitment job, I had to learn about mechanical engineering and electrical engineering and space systems and satellites and and all of that. So is that right? I know how to do the research. It's just about the time that you put into it.
Yeah. What has been the most difficult part of writing and publishing a book?
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually pressing the publish button, essentially the button. There's obviously a few steps, but
yeah,
I hired an editor. It's something I recommend that everyone should do. There's a variety of different types of editing, from like proof, copy, all sorts. So it was then like letting go of your writing. You can always add to it continuously. I still think of things now and I thought, you know, bugger, I should have put that in there.
Yeah.
Or maybe I should have taken that out. But actually it reaches a point where you just have to let it go.
Yeah.
You know, it is what it is. Yes. Yeah, I'm sure you do. I think that's one of the most difficult things probably for anyone that's creating something.
Mm.
I mean, at some points you know, don't you? But for this first time, I was going to make some mistakes. I know I can do better, but you know, that initial stage of actually just letting go of it.
Yeah, letting go of your baby and letting someone else edit it. I'm having trouble with that.
yeah. It's that moment where you've opened the door, isn't it? So, yeah. I mean, you work behind a closed door, you write the book behind a closed door. It's your thoughts and similar for yourself. That editing is behind that closed door. As soon as you open that door and you let people in, you're opening yourselves up to that critique, which I think is very important to do. Obviously, you have to do mm-hmm. that. You know, don't always take everything for what it is. But yeah, that was the difficult part is right, okay, people are actually going to read it now. I'm not sure I'm ready for that, but let's go for it.
So how has it been going since its release?
It's been going well. It has been going well, sort of better than I expected. I think if I was at home, you know, working on the continuous cycle that is marketing, then I think it might be doing slightly better. So I've sold a fair few copies. I think it's probably just all of my family members and my friends that have purchased it, but that's great. I'm down for that. But the fact that we're sort of out cycling, we've been cycling since basically like 3 days after the release date, and we're going to be cycling until hopefully April 2022. I haven't been able to do as much as I would have liked, but I'm all right about that. I'm okay with it. But yeah, it's been going pretty well. It's pretty much available in every retailer or bookshop if you request it, which is nice.
So you came back to the UK, you wrote the book, you're now on a cycling tour. So tell us how you got from writing and publishing the book to where you are now.
So we had this little thing, I don't know whether you've heard, that the pandemic sort of happened.
No, yeah, I think I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Pretty global, actually.
Should really do some reading up on that.
No, not being mean at all, but no, the... So, I mean, that happened basically. So 2020, so start of 2020, mm-hmm. Tasha and I, we got a one-way flight to Rio de Janeiro. This was February. I took my laptop, I took my notes and everything with me, and I was just going to write on, you know, we had like a 24-hour bus ride from Brazil to Argentina and you know, take some time out. And it was going to be quite a long process, but was just going to crack on at any opportunity possible. So we did Rio Carnival, which was awesome. I mean, things that the pandemic had kicked off, you know, like the virus was in Italy and China, and we were, again, like pretty naive. We're like, you know, maybe it won't reach South America or, you know, won't do well in the heat. I think just trying to come up with any excuse for us to stay out there, basically. So it was meant to be a 12-month, give or take, trip. So we were there in February. We arrived in Argentina and Buenos Aires in March. And then Argentina basically went into a bit of a lockdown. So we were still on the case of like, well, you know, we want to get into Argentina. We wanted to go to Patagonia and explore the mountains. So we purchased a tent, like camping gas, a couple of pans, some insulation to sleep on. And we went to the bus station in Buenos Aires and said, you know, can we have two bus tickets to Bariloche, which is sort of like base of the Patagonia. We'd contacted a company to rent a tandem and we were going to cycle over the Andes into Chile and then sort of back round on like a 2-week trip and then just go from there really and find a workaway. And we got to the bus station and we just got refused tickets. And then the police basically escorted us out. They said, in Latin American, you need to come with us. And we were like, okay.
Oh my goodness.
So that was a pretty scary moment. And we were stood outside. We were all masked up. And there's a few police, you know, they've got big automatic rifles and chatting away and trying to sort of navigate between. We'd been learning Spanish, but couldn't get any grips as to what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, there's no travel. You need to go back to your accommodation in Buenos Aires and stay there. So we were like, right, okay. Yeah, we'll go back to the accommodation that we haven't booked or we don't have. So we jumped in a taxi. I said, where do you want to go? We just sort of just said like the center. And we went on Airbnb and we found this accommodation in a place called San Telmo's, this like 100-year-old art building. And we stayed there. So we checked in there for what we thought was going to be a week. That then transpired into 2 weeks and the lockdown got stricter and stricter. You know, at this point, we'd been enjoying South America. Everyone in the UK was fighting over toilet roll and and whatever, God knows what else. So
yeah,
we thought we were in a pretty good situation, actually. And we thought, you know, this is all right. I can write my book. I've got loads of time to do it. Bottles of wine are like £1.50 for a bottle, like a nice bottle of Malbec. Bargain. So that carried on, and that was about 2 months we were there. So we kept on extending the Airbnb. No one else was booking it because no one else could travel or stay away. We were trying to get a flight home. After a while, we realized, right, we have to come home. The insurance is no longer valid.
Right.
If we stay, we paid for a flight home. British Airways was still advertising flights, and they would then cancel them a few days later.
Oh, no.
So you could purchase flights and then they would cancel them. We paid for one flight and we thought, right, okay, well, we're not going to book another one. But we found other Brits in Argentina. Some of them had spent like $5,000 on flights trying to get home.
Oh, wow.
And they just weren't getting refunded from British Airways. So, I mean, we were in a position where we could just wait, but people had come out for like 2 weeks holiday and they needed to get home and were stuck and stranded out there. So this sort of bit of a community formed, like Brits abroad in Argentina. I think it was the same case for every other country that had people abroad.
Was that like a Facebook group?
WhatsApp. Mm-hmm. And then we got a repatriation flight back. So that was organized by, I want to say the government, but I don't know, the government paid some contractor to do it and it was really badly organized. But so we got home, we had to pay like £800 each for a flight. The UK sent out an empty plane to Argentina to pick up a full plane of Brits, and the Argentina sent out an empty plane to the UK to pick up the Argentinians back. Why they couldn't, you know, discuss that we could have, you know, shared the same flight or something.
It's a pandemic, Jim.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, it was an emergency, but come on. That's it. Well, we stopped in Guyana on the way back and they had to like wheel people through to like the middle of the plane. Why didn't you just put them at the front? But anyway, sidetracked.
Anyway,
so what was meant to be 12 months was 2 months. We got home safe and sound. I've written most of the book. I'm a big advocate of pen and paper. I have the handwriting of a 10-year-old, but you know, that's by the by. So we got home and we didn't have anywhere to stay. So we moved in with my dad and it was great. I've not lived with my dad for like 12 years, but it was really good. So Tasha and I moved in, carried on writing the book, started looking for work then at this point, and Tasha was as well. I managed to pick up a contract job. So it was a 3-month contract. It was doing recruitment. Mm-hmm. I figured out that actually this was a much better way of operating than finding a permanent job. We thought we might go away again at some point. Obviously, you know, we've got no idea when the pandemic is going to end. Mm-hmm. This was May at this point, so May 2020. So I got a recruitment job through previous contacts, started working for a satellite manufacturing company in Glasgow, so just working remotely. And then that 3 months just sort of kept on rolling, and I was there for a year. I'd always placed contractors in the first job I'd done, but I never sort of thought of doing contracting myself or sort of on a remote basis. And this has actually opened up a bit of a new path and a new direction. As a contractor, you know, you're not getting involved in the semantics or the politic of the company. You're very much removed from that. You're hired to do a job. So this was like, well, great, you know, I can just do the job and then finish and that's my day done. I don't have to worry about all the other stresses and things that were happening. So
yeah,
that was worked remotely for a year. We sort of moved around a bit. We got our own place in Somerset and then moved up to Bristol. And then, well, it reached June this year. And then we both finished our respective jobs. Travel was sort of opening up a bit. We thought we'd go and explore the UK. The bicycle market has been ridiculous. I think pretty much everywhere in the year. You literally cannot buy a new bicycle, like for a decent one or something specific. I mean, obviously like Halfords has bikes on show, but you know, we wanted a touring bicycle. And the secondhand market is equally, the price has gone up by a couple of £100 per bike.
Why is that then?
Well, it was a pandemic. You know, you're allowed to go out and exercise for your hour a day, everyone took up cycling
because okay.
I suppose a lot more people had disposable income because we weren't going out drinking or eating out. So bicycles became very hard to get hold of. So we managed to get a couple of bicycles secondhand. We got a train up to Glasgow and then we just spent 5 weeks cycling around the Western Isles of Scotland. So that's pretty much been, sort of the last year and a half, 18 months or so. So that was like a trial run, essentially. Scotland's amazing. It's beautiful. It's really, really something special.
So where did the idea, or when did the idea come for going and doing a cycle tour abroad?
Obviously, I'd done the motorbike trip, I sort of started, the book was coming out, was reaching the later stages. I'd started marketing it, and I've created a publishing company called, a brand as such, called A Merry Ride Round. Bit of a play on, obviously, my name's Jim Merrifield, A Merry Go Round. So I thought, riding. So the sort of the brand is anything two-wheeled adventures, basically. So motorbikes, bicycles. I've always had a bit of a love for cycling, and we started following a few pages on Instagram and people are out cycling now. It's obviously sustainable travel, quite love sleeping in a tent, and we just wanted the challenge, really. And we thought we'd do it in the UK, as going abroad was still a bit iffy. So at that point we just sort of went for it. We were going to be cycling in Patagonia in South America, albeit rent a tandem. So we thought we'd just buy our own bikes and get separate bikes, because even if you're in a relationship, you need some time apart. So even if it's 100 meters apart or something, cycling down the same road in the same destination, I still think that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we did 5 weeks in Scotland. We came back for some good friend's wedding in September. I finished off the book, got it out. And then, we got a ferry to Spain in Santander with the bicycles. Now we're in Italy. So we cycled from Santander to Zaragoza to Barcelona. I spent a week there with my cousin. Got the ferry over to Sardinia in the north. Porto Torres, very easy to do. Tasha was actually born in Sardinia. Whilst we were away, her Italian passport got delivered. So she's out travelling on her British one. But
oh, right. Oh, cool.
So we visited her family in Sardinia. We then got the ferry over to Civitavecchia, mainland Italy. Went and visited more family in a beautiful place called Rocantica up in the hills, and stayed with them at their restaurant, ate some superb food, not the sort of, £1 wonders that we'd been cooking on the camp stove. And then we sort of, moseyed our way here. We just missed the snowfall across the Cibollini mountain range. And we're on a workaway, so we're staying in this beautiful farmhouse for a week and building some steps. So in exchange for that. So yeah, it's been good. It's been tough, but it's cold.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it must be so cold on a push bike.
Yeah, there's snow across the hills, but where we are exactly is a bit lower down. So it's not snowing here yet, but we're sort of doing 0 degree nights in the tent. You've just got to have the right equipment, and it is achievable. You can't go out with a two-season sleeping bag from, you need to spend a bit on the right gear, which is why we've been able to do this. Although I came out without any gloves. That was bloody stupid. But we've since managed to pick things up. We're traveling quite lightly on the basis that if we need things, we can get it. But again, end of October, November has been pretty gorgeous in terms of the weather, and there's no tourists, which is great.
That sounds amazing.
I think the only thing I'd add about cycling holidays is that it's so achievable. The ferry's pretty reasonable to Spain. You don't need to get on a plane to do it. If the weather's bad, you can always check in to a hostel or a B&B if push comes to shove, and we've got that option. So I would just recommend it to anyone. It's the best way of traveling and being immersed in nature and such. So awesome. Yeah, really good.
For those trips, did you budget much, or was there anything that you needed to kind of consider there?
Yeah, I mean, we were definitely budgeting, the classic sort of, weigh up all your money and then break it down per day. And then, compensate if we spent more here, then we'd have to spend less there. That was it, really. Obviously, you've got to have the tools and the know-how to at least get to repair shops. Yeah, that was about it, really. I mean, the reason why we're at this workaway actually is because Tasha's bike, her sort of rear gear mechanism, just decided to pack in. And so she came to a halt very quickly, cycling up a hill. Fortunately, we're in Macerata, which is just over the hills, and it's quite a big town. Mm-hmm. There were some shops, but wasn't quite sure. It was a well above my knowledge of fixing bikes. You know, I can repair a tire,
yeah,
and I can do the basic things, but it needed a new part. Things had snapped, so we had to make an emergency booking for an Airbnb, basically, and we spent 2 days there so that we could get to a repair shop. We took it to a repair shop. They bodged it, and we thought, all right, great, it's fixed. We got down the road and the wheel came off, like slipped out of the hold.
Oh my God.
So I thought, right, okay, something's going on here. But I put it back in and thought, oh, right, it's just slipped out. He hasn't done it up properly. Like an hour later, same thing happened again. So we're like, right, okay.
Oh
you
my
know,
God,
we,
was Tasha we're right? Meant
to be, yeah, she was fine. To be fair, I've cycled a lot in my lifetime. Tasha didn't have a bike until about a year and a half ago. She knew how to cycle, but she never really cycled, you know, or done anything. And now, you know, like a year later, we are cycling every day, sort of like 8 o'clock in the morning to, well, currently it's dark at five, so to about sort of 4:30. But if anyone is interested in doing a bicycle ride, you really don't need the experience of cycling to do that, because you can choose how many miles of, you know, you do in a day and go from there, really. So, I mean, fair play to her. She, you know, she handled it really well. She didn't fall off such, but we took it to another bicycle shop who managed to fix it there and then.
Okay.
By which point it was dark and we didn't have anywhere to sleep for the night. So,
oh, no.
We'd been in contact with this work away, and then unfortunately the morning we were meant to come here, they were taken unwell and got and rushed off to hospital. So we're like, right, okay, we're meant to be staying here tonight, but we haven't heard back from them, so we're just going to go and sleep in the woods and camp. So that was pretty cold, but, you know, like I said, we've got the equipment to do so. And now we're here and everything's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how long did it take you to get to where you are now from the UK?
Yeah, so we left middle of October. It took us so just under 2 months, or about just over a month and a half. Mm-hmm. I think we're about 47 days in to our 90 days. And that was, we'd stopped in Zaragoza for like 4 days to sort out some medical things. And then again, we stopped in Barcelona for 5 days. So, you know, we've taken it, like we've cycled, but we've been quite relaxed in terms of if we stop somewhere and we like it, we'll stay.
Yeah.
And we'll commit to enjoying that, you know, without bicycles and walking around and, you know, having a couple of beers or going out for dinner. The fact that we're camping in between those parts means that we're saving money in other areas that yeah. we can enjoy a beer or, you know, or the occasional food out or meal, and then eating quite cheaply in other aspects.
Yeah, awesome. I'm going to move on to the questions now.
Cool.
Throughout all your travels, where is your favourite place that you've ever been?
So I actually had this conversation at my cousin's in Barcelona not long ago. So the first thing that springs to mind is, it was probably on the motorbike journey. It's in Spain. It's a remote place called Castillo de Zafra. So Zafra Castle, essentially. And if you watch Game of Thrones, then it is the, I don't want to give any Game of Thrones spoilers, but it's one of the castles in the Game of Thrones, basically, that Jon Snow is from. And for me, I was there on my own. It's off the track, basically, mm-hmm. in inland Spain, about halfway between Madrid and Barcelona. I just had the like perfect sunset. There was like deers running around, and I go into a bit in the book, and I just had like a bit of, not a magical moment, or you know, but it was just very peaceful, and I think that was sort of one of the time where I realized that, you know, actually I could write something about this place and the trip. It was just a fairly magical place, oh. I thought. It's a small castle that's built on these massive stone rocks,
mm-hmm.
and it's quite spectacular to see.
Oh, amazing. I am also a Game of Thrones fan. I went to,
you are?
Yes.
Yeah.
I Good. Went to, when I was in that area, actually, I went to Girona to see
yeah.
somewhere where they filmed part of Game of Thrones as well. So there you go.
I didn't get to Girona as much. I wasn't aware. Do you know what? I wasn't really aware that the castle was part of Game of Thrones. It was only sort of, I'm not quite sure, I just sort of stumbled across the signpost and I was like, oh, this looks very familiar. But yeah, no, that's cool. A drone is meant to be lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really nice. Beautiful place. Very beautiful.
Nice.
So you've done quite a lot of different jobs through Australia, for example, and throughout your life. What was the best job and what was the worst job you've ever done and why?
I don't know. The banana humping was pretty up there in terms of the best job I had.
Oh, yeah?
I quite enjoyed the physical labour of it. There was just a really good bunch of local people from...
Excuse the pun.
From Cairns. I thought you might like that one.
That's a good pun.
And it was just it was completely different. It was a short amount of time. I think if I'd done it for a longer period, then maybe I would have got a bit bored of it. But it was like 6 weeks, you know, humping bananas in the morning and then cutting leaves basically in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. I was staying on this campsite with loads of nationalities of people, and it was just this fantastic community vibe. I got helped out a lot. So it was more the environment that I was in was part of why that was probably the best job.
And the worst?
The worst? Door knocking, selling solar panel appointments in the rain was pretty shit. to be honest, just lots of like gated communities where, you know, they're very much out on their own and in for themselves. And then painting and decorating probably comes a close second,
yeah.
I think. Yeah, a close second as worst jobs. But yeah, I've done quite a variation of jobs. Yeah.
You've gone through quite a lot of different experiences throughout your journeys, but was there ever a time, or when was the time, where you felt most like you just didn't know what to do next?
Yeah, there has been a lot of times, I think, in work and whilst traveling as well, where that's come across. But the point I mentioned earlier, I ran out of money in Australia. I had a truck, I had assets, but, you know, that's no good. You know, didn't have any money. A bit like Richard Branson, where he's, you know, owns all these islands, but he needs a bailout from the government. I needed a bailout at that point. I had a... Inevitably, it sort of starts with worry and then usually a bit of swearing and pulling your hair out. But ultimately, it's a case of... I typically would then take a deep breath, try and document all of the options that I've got, weigh up the options, and then do some research about it and try and make an informed decision to be able to do that. But I don't know, quite often just ignore all of that and usually go with what your heart is telling and then use your head to figure it out along the way. So yeah, I don't know, a bit of a variety. There's definitely been a few cases, I say specifically the needing the job in Australia and ruining my chances by putting my foot in it that I was only going to be around for a few weeks. But yeah.
You made a way around it anyway.
Made a way around it. And
still got that job.
That's it, yeah. And I've then used that like scenario or thinking, well, okay, I managed to get a job by changing my name. You know, it was still my real name, mm-hmm. but I managed to get that job. So there's always another door to open.
Yeah.
Usually there's another way around things if there's a no at the first one then.
Yeah. Through each period of travel that you've done, which was your favourite period of travel?
The best period of travel for me was probably the first one. So sort of through Asia, it was about 9 months in total. So through Asia, a couple of months in Australia, hitchhiking with a skateboard. I'm still not very good at skateboarding, in case you're wondering, but that first... just because I had no idea what I was doing. There was quite a lot of difficulties and a lack of money and figuring out actually, yeah, you can do all these things on not very much.
In your opinion, what is the best thing about going and doing these kind of tours around different places?
For me, it's the variation of challenges is the best thing, really. It keeps you limber. Probably doesn't keep you young. I think I'm 27 going on 50, but it definitely opens your eyes and just being able to take a step back from what is quite a stressful world mm-hmm. to live in. And life, for me, it gives me the opportunity to learn about things I'm interested in, you know, people and places from sort of firsthand experience. I'm doing that now with Tasha. We're traveling together, but I think it's the most important thing for me was when I did it on my own as a, you know, you're on your own accord to an extent. You stay places for a while when you start to get a security blanket around you with, mm-hmm. with the people that you get to know, as I'm sure you're aware. But it's the process of learning how to do that. And you can take those experiences right through life. Like I said, I didn't have a concrete job from leaving college to the age of 23, but I traveled and I wasn't studying. But in every interview that I had, I was able to give an experience of something that I did when I was working abroad, not even just working, but, you know, but traveling abroad.
If you hadn't gone traveling, what do you think you would be doing now?
Do you know what? I would probably still be in recruitment, a little bit miserable with loads of money. Well, at least for what is a load of money for me. Because I had been traveling to start with for sort of on and off over that period of time, when things got pretty difficult, when I was working and I was 3 years into the sort of the office job and I thought, you know, is this it? I think if I hadn't have been traveling before, then I wouldn't have made the realization, at least not on my own, that that was when I was happiest. I could do that again. That is more of my passion and I could potentially make something of that. So yes, I would probably still be at home, which I love, and I've always loved going back to it. But I might be in something that doesn't push my buttons quite as much as doing this and trying to figure out a career path from it.
So throughout all your travels, where feels most like home?
Do you know what? Nowhere else really feels like home.
Haven't had that answer yet.
Not sure if that's what you expected or not, but I'm very fortunate from the home that I come from, mm-hmm. not just because it's Cheddar, but also I've, yeah, very strong friends network back home. I've got my rugby club who I love, family, and it's also just a fantastic part of the UK, that perfect mix of nature of the southwest, and Bristol is the city, so there is nowhere quite like home, I'm afraid. I love being away, but I do miss it.
So you don't think you'll ever move away permanently then?
Not for the rest of my life. I could definitely move somewhere. Tasha and I have talked about it, about living in places for a few years. I could definitely do that. In which case, we could definitely live in Italy. Tasha's Italian, but she doesn't speak Italian, so that's a bit of a goal. But also Granada has been somewhere that I would love to live.
Ah, okay.
For a period of time. But yeah, there's no place quite like home.
Did you hear episode 2 of the podcast?
I did.
Lara Parsons.
I did.
Yeah, she did her stint in Granada. I think that's where she is now. She's back in Spain. That was her.
I'm not surprised. It's pretty mesmerizing. Just fantastic music and mix of cultures. And I'm not surprised she's gone back there. I pretty much listened to all of your episodes, Gina. I think they've been really good.
Thank you. So when you're away from home, what do you miss the most? We've had everything from biscuits to parents. So.
So I think, yeah, a few things. I miss playing rugby, or at least being around the rugby club. Play for a little village, Winscombe RFC. Shout out to Winscombe, up the boys. I do miss playing rugby, or at least watching on the sideline. I miss that. I miss a pint of beer. You know, we can quite easily get a bottle of lager or a draft lager out here, but yeah, a nice pint of ale, probably from a pub called the Hunter's Lodge in Priddy, which probably gets the award for being the most ugliest building in the UK, but inside it's just like lovely, homely, fires on, there's, you know, usually a band playing some country music, and yeah, it's very nice.
Very nice.
And family and friends, I'd have to say family and friends, obviously. Yeah.
Of course.
No, but that is a large part of it. I've got a young nephew and niece who I do miss.
Aww.
Yeah, my brothers as well.
Yeah. If you could go back and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
Yeah, find out a bit earlier in life that meaningful work is probably one of the secrets to happiness, really. And be creative with that. I think I probably could have explored more options going into university, and I could have started down a career path in that sense. I don't regret anything I've done I regret a few things, but the path that I've taken. Yeah. I think just do more research earlier on and be aware of what the options are.
Awesome. And on the topic of advice, what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
Look both ways when you cross the road. Is the best piece of advice I've ever given. And my granny gives it to me every time I leave. I've got it stitched into my notebook. So at the start of every notebook, I write, look both ways when you cross the road. I think you can take that as a literal sense, but also as in any other way as well, because I think there is, yeah, often things incoming that you might not be aware about. So you have to use all of your senses to take that on board. So whether my granny meant it in that way, I think she was just being quite literal. She also said, don't talk to any strange men. But so yeah, that's probably the best advice I've ever received. But someone said, follow your own journey as well. It's easy to see what other people are doing by all means, but take inspiration from them and make it your own.
Mm-hmm. Great advice, yeah. On the show, we talk a lot about mentors. Did you have any mentors in your journey?
Yes, the earlier stages of life, I think. I'm very fortunate with the parents that I have and the values that they've instilled in me. Obviously, my granny's just the best. Mad as a hatter. And you read about her in the book. She's pretty incredible.
You actually dedicated your book to granny, didn't you?
I did. I did indeed. Yeah, she's a marvellous person. I think when I was away and sort of travelling and actually out on journeys, especially in like the earlier stages from like 18 through to 21, although age isn't really the problem. Or the issue, rather. It's more that taking those first steps and how you learn about things when you're away. I'm not sure I had a particular mentor as such, but I would just ask questions to anyone who had more experience than me.
Obviously, you've told us that Granny told you to look both ways, but do you have any quotes or sayings that you live by?
Yes, to a degree. There's a couple in the book that I sort of came across, say it was a few years ago, really. One is by a chap called Edward Abbey, who's an American environmentalist. Mm-hmm. So a mental person that basically looks to protect the environment. And that is, save the other half of yourselves and your lives for pleasure and adventure. It's not enough to fight for the land. It is even more important to enjoy it. Sit quietly for a while and contemplate the precious stillness, the lovely, mysterious and awesome space. Wow. I read that quite a bit.
Yeah.
Mainly because it gives me justification to go out and travel and enjoy, but also to maybe turn a bit more of a passion into a possible work path.
Yeah.
And the other one is also in the book in the early stages is The Secret of Happiness. Find something more important than you are and dedicate your life to it. Mm-hmm. So that, I mean, that could be what, however you look to interpret that, I think it can be done in many ways, but I think it's got something to say.
Yeah, that's awesome. Cool. Do you have any books, movies, publications, or anything like that that you can recommend to our listeners that have helped you on your path? Or can you name one thing that has inspired you recently?
Yes, I do have some things that have inspired me recently. Am I all right to quote another podcast on a podcast?
Yeah, of course. Is that all right? Yeah, we like promoting podcasts.
We love podcasts.
We love podcasts.
We love the podcasts. We do.
Yeah, please.
So there's a podcast called John Richardson and the Future Noughts. Mm-hmm. John Richardson is that comedian guy from, I think it's 8 out of 10 Cats.
Okay.
He's very funny and he's good. It's basically something that I've found interested in and I think is more important than myself, and I'm going to start looking to sort of dedicate my life to it from that quote earlier. Mm-hmm. It's basically three nerds that look at the current systemic impact of the world in a very clever and humorous way.
Nice.
It sort of opens the door to some things that I had no idea about in terms of sort of consumerism. But the one thing that really stuck actually was how they were talking about work paths and different careers and how you navigate your way through that happiness, really. The one thing they said is that there's no direct route to finding what works for you. Mm-hmm. So they say your career will not make sense in the windscreen of a car, but it will make sense in the rearview mirror. So it's more about the values that you choose guiding you through life rather than trying to find a specific job that you think will work for you. You'll eventually find that job where your values and passions meet if you keep them true. And if you don't, then you'll hate your job and you'll become one of the 85% of people that hate their jobs, apparently. It's the current statistic. That really stuck. So I was like, right, okay. That gave me a real desire to try and put more effort into making a bit of a difference. But at the moment, I'm currently enjoying the adventure and the fruits of labour and what the world can give. So yeah, that is definitely one thing that inspired me recently.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll have to give that a listen. So you're not a seasonaire, but I'm going to ask you this about travel. What is one myth about travel life that you would like to debunk?
I think it's just the fact that it's all laugh and play. It's not. It is a challenge. It's not a full-time job, obviously. Most of the time you're doing what you want, but it can be very challenging. It can be lonely. It is important that you approach and deal with that solitude. That can be a challenge. So yeah, the fact that you're just going to have the best time all the time is not the case.
Doesn't sound very happy.
No, it doesn't. Well, no.
It's the still truth. Good though.
It is still bloody brilliant. It's the best thing that you can do. You learn a lot about yourself, but there are challenges.
Yeah.
Yeah, from a mental perspective, but also in just the experience and then how you approach yourself in the next steps.
Yeah, for sure.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Now I have to ask you Mark Lender's favourite question, my mum's favourite question.
Mark Lender.
Yes. Big up Mark Lender. What's one thing you take with you everywhere you travel, or do you have any travel hacks?
I always take juggling balls with me.
Juggling balls?
Juggling balls.
Why?
Yeah.
That's so random. I like it, but it's random. Why is that?
So I started juggling when I was like 8 years old, possibly younger. Yeah, for a bit, like a little bit of a circus family, we've sort of always had various things around the house. But I then really started getting into it sort of through exams and revision. I felt like it's a really good way of concentrating, but also it's a bit like meditation, really. So I would just juggle for a long time in between revision breaks. There was a talent show at the Camp America that I did for the staff, and I thought, all right, okay, I'll do some juggling. Oh, cool. I'm not very good. Like, I can juggle with three balls continuous and do a few tricks. I mean, you've seen people do like 8, 9, whatever.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd do this talent show and I'd juggle somewhat. And then this kid went out who's 13 and he was juggling with like 7 balls, juggling with like rings and clubs. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what have I signed myself up for? And I went out and I was rubbish, but they all had a lot of fun laughing at me, so I joined in. It was quite amusing. But yeah, juggling balls. I used to juggle on the side of the road in Australia if I hadn't been picked up for a little while, so hitchhiking. I think that helped. It passes the time,
yeah,
very well. And for those sort of, you know, lonely moments. I've taught a few kids to juggle. Mm-hmm. So in the time of like, we were in Brazil and we were cycling around a place and I just had my juggling balls on me and there was a kid who was sort of running around throwing stones and I said, oh, you know, why don't you try the juggling balls? And I don't know whether they can juggle now or whether it worked or not, but yeah, it's just a very, I don't know, I've just always carried juggling balls.
That's awesome. Yeah, my mum will love that.
Good.
And any travel hacks?
Travel hack is definitely for me is pack less than you think you need, mm-hmm. especially for cycling or even backpacking. I've seen some, you know, enormous bags on the back of people's backs, but pack less than you need. Leave yourself a bit of space to purchase things when you're away. You don't need to take everything with you. Everything is pretty much accessible wherever you go, unless, you know, right out in the middle of nowhere. Yeah, definitely pack less than you need. I realise that cycling up a couple of hills in Scotland. But yeah, so found that out the hard way.
Awesome. For you, what was the biggest lesson learned from your travels?
Main thing for me really was money comes and goes. Debt lasts as long as your memories. So I just chose to have more memories than debt, really. Mm-hmm. You know, that has been the most enjoyable thing. I think, like I said earlier as well, you know, the diverse experience, it keeps you limber. You know, you're ready to tackle challenges, you know, however scary that they are. Mm-hmm. I know anything that comes onto my plate now that I have done something similar or something varied in the past and I overcome it. For example, I get quite nervous, like ringing librarians trying to tell them to stock my book or like bookshops. And mm-hmm. But I know I have done that type of thing in the past. I just need to be able to talk about myself and the book and do that. So, and I think you get that from doing stints on your own and yeah, and working and traveling. So
yeah, it's just pushing through that barrier, isn't it, in your mind?
Yeah.
'Cause once you get through it, generally you're onto something good. Well, you're definitely making progress, but it's just pushing through that little barrier in your mind that says, oh, I'm a bit nervous about doing this.
Exactly. I mean, typically you can do that from working at home or in your office as well. I think the traveling aspect just gives you that variation. to take on different things rather than it all being down the same channel.
Yeah, yeah. If you were in my shoes, what's one question you would have asked that I didn't?
I was going to say, do you have any questions for the host? We want to learn a little bit more about Gina.
What do you want to know? Okay, I'll give you one question. You can pick any of the questions.
I spent 4 years interviewing people, so I'm more used to doing the interviewing.
You're probably better at it than me.
No, definitely not, Gina. Definitely not.
Go for it. Shoot.
What's next for you, Gina?
What's next for me or the podcast?
Yeah. What's next for you? Whether that's podcast based, whether that's what avenues are you looking to explore, and how do you think you're going to get there?
That's a really good question. I am looking to monetize the podcast in some way and actually make this a full-time job so that I can obviously bring people more content and more podcasts, more things to listen to. So at the moment I am, trying to get that done, putting together a media kit, which is now on my website. I've been concentrating on building a website and just, trying to get more people to listen and
awesome.
And try and make a bit of a business out of this so I can do it full time. So we'll see how that goes. But yeah, it kind of resonated with me when you said that whole, it's scary when you call the libraries and ask them to stock your book. It's a bit nerve wracking. I have that when I'm kind of approaching people for either sponsorships or want to work with partners in trying to monetize, and it is just pressing that button. Like, you might get rejected. So it's a scary thing, but it is pressing that send on that email and things like that. And you're just like, once you've done it, it's done, but you build it up in your mind. And it's, I think over the years of, again, doing travel experiences or seasons that have been very much so out of my comfort zone, you just learn to just do it anyway. So, because regardless of whether you're going to get rejected or whatever, if you don't press the button, you'll never know. So, yeah.
You'll never know. Exactly. That's it. You never know. Well, there you are, folks. So, yeah, check out the website. Spread the word. Gina is on the hunt for sponsorship. Here we go.
Yeah, here we go.
Let's get it out there.
Thanks for asking. That was a good, I like that.
I really enjoyed that. Yeah, I really enjoyed that answer. That was really good.
So is there anyone that you would like to nominate to come on the podcast?
Yes, there is. I think our mutual friend Nathan would be a bit of a laugh. He's currently out in Canada at the moment. There's also a guy, Sven, I'm going to pronounce his last name wrong, Alschwein. That's definitely wrong. He's a Dutch guy that I met on the flight over from Kuala Lumpur to Perth on that first stretch of travel. He spent a couple of years there. He's now working in France. I'm not entirely sure what doing, but he spent significantly longer traveling on various expeditions than I have. I think it'd be really great.
Awesome.
So we actually met in the airport and we were chatting away and we thought, oh, okay, have a good flight. Might see you at the other end. Good luck. And then we were sat next to each other on the plane. Like our seats were, it was meant to be. So we got absolutely hammered and then on the flight. And then he crashed at my uncle's place in Perth for a couple of days. So yeah, it was good. Nice guy.
What's next for you and for the book, and what are your future plans?
I mean, we plan to be back from this cycle trip in April, sort of 2022. That being said, plans change. COVID is pretty rife at the moment. So, we'll see. We might be back sooner. Mm-hmm. We are on the way to Croatia. We can get to Croatia, then we have a fresh 90 days visa, because they don't abide by the same visa rules for Brits. So we'll probably spend a couple of months there. We'll be back in for next year in the summer. We've got a few family and friends weddings. I've got the option of picking up contract work if I need it. And then if I say it now, then I'm going to have to do it. I'm going to start writing a second book.
Excellent.
So yeah.
Exclusive. That might be hot off the press.
No. I think it was always the way. I think you can't create a publishing company and only publish one book. That's a pretty poor show, isn't it? So I'm not quite sure which route I'm going to take it, but there'll be a collection of short stories in one book, sort of over the first years of traveling, and some of the stories that we haven't discussed will go in there, and then possibly about more of a cycling memoir. We'll see. I don't know. But yeah, I'm going to head down that route. And if I need to pick up some recruitment work to fund it and get things going, then then that's what I'd have to do.
Awesome. Sounds like a plan. And where can people buy your book, Iberia by Bike?
So it is available in the UK from Waterstones. If you absolutely have to, you can get it from Amazon, but would rather you didn't. It's Book Depository. If you want to support your local bookshops, you can go and request it through them. Mm-hmm. Probably take a 10 days for them to get it in, but they will get some money for doing that. Or libraries is the same. So it's available online. Also on my website, which is amerryrideround.com, and then there's a books tab which has a link to all of those retailers. I've been told it's available worldwide, so like Barnes and Noble and things in the States and all sorts. Yeah,
awesome, exciting stuff. If anyone wants to contact you and find out any more information or see what you've been up to, where can they find you?
So primarily on Instagram. There is a Facebook page as well. It's all under A Merry Ride Round. And that's the same for the website as well, .com or Jim Merrifield. Happy to answer any questions about places visited. There's sort of a lot of things off the beaten track. So yeah.
Before we go, we're coming up to the end now. So before we go, do you have one last parting piece of advice for anyone who's thinking of embarking on a travel journey themselves?
It's just sort of the staple diet advice, really, is just do it. Even if you don't enjoy it, you're going to learn a lot from it. To start off with, take inspiration from other people's journeys, you know, where they've been, what they've done, but be sure to put your own twist on it, because, you know, what's right for them, not necessarily going to be right from yourself. Yeah, just got to go and get it done. It provides a lot of meaning if you're struggling to find something that's meaningful. If you're struggling to find anything at all, it gives you a lot of time for that reflection. And if you give it enough time, eventually things will work themselves out. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not quite worked itself out for me yet, but I'm definitely on a better path than I was, and one that I look to keep on exploring, really.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you so much, Jim. It has been so much fun to catch up, and it's been a really great chat. So thank you so much for coming on.
You're so welcome, Gina. Thank you very much. I thoroughly enjoyed that.
What an awesome story. Thanks again to Jim for coming on the show today. If you'd like to get your hands on a copy of Iberia by Bike, head to the link in the show notes where you can order a copy today, or head over to our Instagram at That Season Air Podcast and get involved in our giveaway. Don't forget to give us a follow on Instagram for all the latest information, and click subscribe on your favourite podcast player to get all new releases as they come out. Once again, a big thank you to Mike at Mike's Sports Bar for the studio space. Thank you to Mondo Wave for the music, and thanks to you guys for tuning in. See you all again next time.
You didn't pick me up on that one.
No, I didn't. I was like, where are we going here?
Yeah.